Hello, welcome to another episode of Unfinished Business. It's the podcast about making a living in design with me, Richard Rutter, and with him,
Andy Clark.
Hi, Andy. How are you?
I'm sweltering, to be honest. North Wales has never had it so hot. There are people out there on inflatable dolphin lilos. You can't move for toffee apples and seagulls swooping to eat your chips. So it's a bit warm, but that's what you get for, you know, living in a holiday destination, as you know.
So it stopped raining, has it? I mean, it's Wales.
It doesn't always rain in Wales.
I know. It's a lovely country.
But it's been great. We actually went to, speaking of seagulls, we went to Conwy the other day just to pick up a wedding present for my brother who's getting married at the weekend. And we thought, we'll have a pasty, because there's a particular Welsh pasty. They call it an oggy. So we thought, right, let's go and get one of these things fresh from the bakers and then go and sit down on the seafront. So that's what we did. And 5 minutes later, the seagulls had arrived. So they're flipping, swooping all over the place trying to get these pasties. So I put one down the side of me. I broke a bit off, put the rest of it down the side of me so I could keep these seagulls off. And the next thing I know, bloody seagull craps right on top of the remains of my pasty. So I didn't get a pasty. So I was very cross about that.
Evil things. I mean, down here in Brighton, we get some really nasty seagulls. I've had them snatch a croissant out of my hand as I was walking down the street, and I'm probably not the only one. But there we are.
Brutal. Brutal little bastards. So we have a guest today.
We do indeed. So she's a designer, speaker, mentor, agency co-founder, which is why she's here, and was born in a country that no longer exists. So please welcome Alex Melnikova. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Unfinished Business. How are you doing?
Hey, Alex.
Hi, Rach and Andy. I'm good. Equally like yourselves, very, very hot in London. And I'm on the river, so we have a lot of both seagulls and a lot of heat. So,
I'm intrigued. Which country no longer exists?
Big experiment that failed in many ways and still keeps giving. Soviet Union.
Oh. Yeah. So which part of the Soviet Union?
I was born in Lithuania, independent Lithuania. Now, thank God. So I was born there and I studied there. I went to Academy of Arts. My first degree is in art, actually. And then I left for Italy to learn a bit more about the culture, but also to study something that was the first service design course in Europe, product service systems design.
Wow, where was that?
That was in Politecnico di Milano, in Milan. It's interesting, in London I meet a lot of people from the same space and they're usually service designers. There's just this service design community.
Why on earth did you leave Milan to come to London then? Why would anyone do that?
Oh, I can tell you, Rich, I like pace a lot, pace and work and sort of, I love Italian food and climate and everything else, but I was working in an agency and I found it initially quite difficult and slow to progress. And I like moving fast, not breaking things, just making things, moving fast. And so I felt like there could be a different place for me to apply my skills best. And that was London. And that was 18 years ago with two suitcases and no connections in London. That was a big adventure.
Wow. Wow. That's quite a lot has changed since then.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I studied fine art as well. But I think I studied fine art possibly 1 or 2 years before you. Just a few. Just a few. Be kind to me.
I mean, it did match through the year, so I bet we studied very similar things about the good old fine art. Whoops.
What? I went to art school thinking that I would be a famous painter. And then after about a week, compared to the other people that were there, I realized that I was a terrible painter. And ended up spending my 3 years doing printmaking.
Oh,
so what was your specialty?
As it turns out, our education was very, very wide. Very, so I did painting, sculpture, drawing, history of art, history of philosophy, even physics, a lot of different subjects in sort of those 2-3 years that I was studying. And so my specialty is that I didn't know what I wanted to do because I was so interested in why rather than what. I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to make another chair. I had a bit of a product design course for a year. I was like, God, okay, standard ergonomics. That's all I need to understand from that. I didn't want to sort of, I'm going to use the word pollute, but like create more things without thinking what we actually need to create in order to solve some of the things that are already here and require work. And so then the service design course, it was a chance. I went as an exchange student. I won like a scholarship, a year's worth of scholarship. And I picked courses. I was allowed as a sort of second year student to pick any courses from masters. And I picked a lot of like random courses and I studied history. Am I again, like very different operator work, like all sorts of interesting things. And so in the university, then I guess I got a bit noticed. So then I got invited to study for my master's there.
Hmm. See, I went to what was Trent Polytechnic, which is now Nottingham Trent University, because everything's got very posh. Everything has to be a university. But I purposefully did what they called an unstructured course, which was... essentially, you turn up on day one and they go, hello. And then they come back 3 years later and say, what did you do? And that was great because having figured out that I was a terrible painter, it gave me the freedom then to go and experiment with lots of other things. And it taught me two things, I think. One is self-motivation. And... you know, literally, you just had to keep going. You know, you could get tutorials if you wanted. And some people couldn't really handle that unstructured aspect of the course. So they went deep into a very structured environment. So they spent, you know, 3 years in the life room doing, you know, nude portraits. I, on the other hand, tried out a load of things and got very into photography and very into printmaking. And I think the other thing that it taught me was that one thing that I really enjoy is process. Whether it's developing photographs in a dark room or the process of lino cuts and lino printing and things like that. So did you take away anything from your fine art degree?
I still paint. I still sculpt quite a bit. I think what I took away is that desire to learn and know more things and like the meta learning. So I can learn about a subject matter within a couple of days, really, really in depth, and then start understanding and proposing certain solutions based on, of course, you know, speaking with people and so on. But that's the skill that I think I have developed there, that sort of looking at the big picture and being able to link some of the history with some of the methods, with some of the things that we were doing and sort of on the ground and without sort of refusing anything. So like we had like 15 or 16 subjects in half a year. It was like mentally and cognitively, it was quite difficult degree actually, but it was so invaluable. I'm so grateful that I'm still reading about a lot of things and I come back to them and go, actually, oh, I can use this exercise on like abstracting a painting with my design team, for example, and I can use certain steps and certain methodologies. So I like creating new frameworks.
Not to kind of go down a complete tangent, but I think that's fascinating because one thing I've found over the years, and I think this is one of the reasons why I personally think that web design is utterly, dreadfully boring for the most part at the moment. The stuff that I see is, you know, terrible. And I think a lot of that is because people that put things on screen don't necessarily either have that historical context, they haven't learned about, you know, what's gone before, or they're not really curious enough to say, hey, I wonder what if I did this? I don't know. What is that something that you've come across?
I'll tell you more. I think I can relate to some of it. I think the main problem that I see now is that there are not enough designers sometimes knowing how the thing is going to get built and the creative way of building. So when the developers are incentivized on building at speed and the designers are incentivized on producing something that just meets user needs, therein lays the disconnect of like the handover and the trying to kind of bridge this gap, whilst the best collaborations we had certainly over the past 3 years is creative developers working with sort of accessibility oriented designers, for example, and designers
knowing
how you're going to build. There you go, like that's exactly like at the end the whoever is using the app, the site, whatever we're building digital service, they don't really see all these iterations. They actually interact with code is code. I feel that's a very, very important part of what we do at Cosmic, certainly, is we work super close with developers and it's not a handover exercise.
Well, we could talk about this for the entire hour, but I'm sure Rich has got much more interesting things than developer handover processes to talk about.
Well, I could probably talk about that for a few hours as well, but... Yeah, it was interesting, Annie, you were saying that you found out you were not a great painter. I was told that when I was about 9, literally told that by my art teacher. Paint defeats him, is what my report says. And I have no idea how I even had the audacity to describe myself as a designer many decades later, but somehow it worked out. I still can't paint, wouldn't go anywhere near paint. But, excuse me, so Alex, you've had a lot of experiences, you were saying, both agency side and, I guess, from an agency point of view, client side. And yet you still started up an agency. Was it 3 years ago with Stephen Tomlinson, Cosmic Velocity? So tell us a little bit about Cosmic Velocity and you know, how that came about.
I can tell you the name, how the name came about.
Thank you.
It's sort of an internal joke. It's about escaping a gravitational pull of a larger body, physically speaking. And we were all, so I went through about 5 acquisitions in my time in agencies. Every time that I would get to the team, I would build an amazing team. And then at some point, through circumstances or the founder sort of wanting to go on to the next steps, it would get sold. And more often than not, it would get sold. Our product design agency would get sold to an advertising network or an advertising. And therein would be a clash of values where with advertising, you kind of want to sell to people. And with product, you want to solve things for people within their lives and like help that them live in some way more fulfilling processes and services and so on. And so I faced that again and again and again. And finally, in the last agency, I've built an amazing team. And that happened again. And all of us were, I had this very feeling of, oh, I would really love to still experience the feeling of working within a very geeky, very smart, very interested group of people. But I just don't want to necessarily lead a big team anymore for someone who's going to choose a different course. And so that was a necessity. And also, I was really tired of pitching. I have pitched and been a part of the new business team for ages. And I distilled the art of doing it to perfection. But I think pitching sort of speculative work is just such a waste of design talent. And so I wanted to do it very, very differently in our own agency. Which we have with pitch capability and previous work and approach. We don't pitch speculative work. And unfortunately, advertising agencies do. So there was like a lot of levels, it was like, right, what's the next step? I can, of course, go and head up another team somewhere else. And perhaps that course will be chosen for me, or I can chart my own path. So that's what I've done.
Certainly pitch. With you on the speculative design of pitching. I mean, obviously there are pitches that as agencies you need to go through, but that's persuading clients to go with you, not showing them some pictures that you've come up with in a matter of days without doing any research or anything like that. And she said, we've never had that. But we haven't had that sort of advertising background either. And that's an area that we've never touched, perhaps for that very reason, because we didn't want to get involved in that sort of, in that world.
Yes, Andy, you were saying something.
Well, I was actually interested in what Rich just said there about the no speculative work policy, because it is a complete and utter waste of creative effort that, you know, we could be spending our time making something much, much more valuable, either for ourselves or for, you know, for a paying client. But I like this idea that, you know, the name of the company reflects that desire to do something your own way. So I suppose the next question might be, what's your exit? Would you sell this thing and do to others what's been done to you?
It's really early to say. My path for the next at least 10 years is to grow this. Whether we will have things like products as a part of our... So here's a designer's view, right? You get in and we realize, for example, that, I don't know, accounting software is quite rubbish. There are so many products that we created custom dashboards for ourselves, like reporting revenue, profit, like all these things. We just, there is a sort of service level for the enterprise level agencies, and I guess that software is better marginally. I've tested some of it. But then like a huge gap, and we felt like we have to like redesign our methods. We now optimized our decks to like a really good level. We're doing all these things, and it's like still exciting to grow that and to scale that as a good business, which operates by the rules of design inside. Not just like us because it scales. So that's what's interesting for me. Long term, like, I don't know. We're both designers. So both Stephen and I are practitioners and agency founders. So there is a tricky balance to hold. But I don't think we can ever not work, unfortunately, because we're just very passionate about what we do. So I guess at the moment, it's about growth.
Hopefully, we'll speak to you before 10 years.
Yes.
Yeah, so both you and Stephen are still able within the structure of Cosmic Velocity to actually do work for clients and to design continually.
Yes, yeah. We are. And we always have. I always have as a head of department. So my biggest team was about 30, but I was before Cosmic for 8 years, I was heading up different teams. And I always made it a point that, sure, I redesigned structure. I actually did it doubled a lot within sort of HR and learning. So I designed like culture manuals, different rituals, facilitated even some of those mergers and some of the alignments between the teams and the needs and their vision and things like that. So I really like sort of both facilitating those workshops between people who either have never met or spoken or trying themselves on the same page. And then creating artifacts that then support that journey is really exciting. I have always been doing the work. Now it's more and more for me, UX and research. I train a lot of people on how to do research. So part of what we do at Cosmic, we have, you can see, two strands. So there's product design, and that includes research, UX, UI. And then there is training. We train in design thinking and service design, inclusive research and inclusive design. So I literally recently just got back from Scotland, actually last week, trained very senior people within a certain organization on design thinking and how that applies to their jobs.
Yeah, that's certainly an aspect that we find ourselves doing at Clear Left as well. We found that was just, it's almost like an extension of doing a good job in a way, because as an agency, you're not there the whole time. You do a job, you redesign something, you do the research. And then it's a point where either they don't need you anymore or they haven't got the money for you anymore, but you can't leave the team hanging there. Often they need a bit of upskilling at the very least to be able to run with what you've done either for them or with them. And that's sort of where the training that we've ended up doing has sort of come out of. It's sort of that and, yeah. So I have to ask, why you and Stephen? Why Stephen in particular?
So we started...
How did you get to know Stephen in the first place?
Well, I was his direct boss. But yeah, partly... So we started, three of us, me, Stephen, and Olena. So Olena Boligina was a third co-founder. She's Ukrainian. And I known them both as a part of my team. And as I mentioned, like when this whole merger happened, for us, it was clear that there is a big values clash. And so none of us wants to stay or work. And so I guess more specifically why Stephen, I can definitely answer that question. He's one of the smartest people I know who knows everything about everything. And if he doesn't yet know it, he's going to read about it now, and then he's going to tell it back to you in 15 minutes from like three different viewpoints. And that always fascinated me, that passion for knowledge and that sort of drive to perfection in design. And that can be like a difficult thing. The design is never good enough. Could also be, for me, in the sea of a lot of people that I've seen working within the industry that are like, it's fine, it's an MVP. And to that sort of passion for really making products that work very well for people, that like stood out for me.
Yeah, well, I'm nodding because we worked with Stephen a little bit just before you got going with Cosmic, and yeah, fantastic designer, as you say, just wants everything to be just so, and he's so smart at just learning new things very, very quickly. It's quite a skill. So I can understand why you would want to set up with him.
Yes, and he made our processes so much better. So we have this running joke in an agency. I do come back sometimes from like new client meetings and I'm like, I have good news and bad news. But the good news is usually like, we have this amazing thing, but the bad news is that it's in 3 days. And then the 3 days, we do the amount of work that like is required, like monolithic amount. And Stephen is the only one who can really make it happen together with myself and the team. And he provided an immense structure to our agency. So all those dashboards that I mentioned, like he taught, despite us having sort of financial advisors and accountants and people like that, they use his designed things very often, and they learn from us, and then they implement with other clients. They mentioned recently saying that our relationship has been in that way very mutually.
I hope they're giving you a discount.
I think they are.
So, if you're not pitching, where do you get your work from? How does it land in your doorway?
Oh, it's an interesting one. Word of mouth plays a lot of... So first year, we used our networks extensively. So I worked with so many clients in different agencies, and they were all like, what are you doing now? And I freelanced for about 2 years whilst my daughter was born, when she was little, like sort of between 2 and 4. And so there were a lot of people who knew me and who knew Stephen and who knew Elena and who were like, okay, now we want to work with you. And so, yeah, first couple of years, even a year and a half, it was very our networks. And now it's word of mouth. And we keep saying we need to work more within a certain space, because we have a few clusters of clients that are in spaces that we're super interested in. For example, green energy. We have 3 clients there, and we've designed software and dashboards for energy measurement and things like that. And so we are speaking with and attending events that are relevant to this. But this is more events where it's sort of industry rather than, you know, UX, UI. It's more like, how do we make green energy related things happen, CO2 emissions reducing and things like that. So we find work through that too. Sometimes people reach out to us just naturally as an outreach saying, we've seen you do great stuff, how about you work with us? And that also happened magically. Yeah.
In episode 2, we talked about kind of accidental specialisms, and sometimes you can do that. Where you do a really good job for one client, and somehow word gets around, and you end up doing that for another 2 clients in that same area. And yeah, it does help if it's an area you're into, and I can imagine green energy would definitely be one of those.
Yes, we somehow have clients that really align with our values through these 3 years. And we actually, values was one of the first exercises we've done. And it's about nerdiness, meaning, inclusion. We do a lot of, I do a lot of research with people with disabilities, with children with disabilities, with just very diverse population. And we just make sure that all of our research that clients come to us for is inclusive. So they don't need to think about it. We think about it. And that has in the long term been really, really good for like other people hearing about it and going, can you do this training for us, or can you work with us in this space?
I was going to say, do you do any promotion? Do you worry about what you're putting out on LinkedIn or social media channels or your own company blog? What are you doing in terms of outreach?
We do LinkedIn. I do LinkedIn. Some of my team have admin rights as well. They do LinkedIn. We post opinions and we're quite opinionated on the space. So the only issue we run into is just the time. Sometimes work and sort of prospective work takes precedence and then we go a bit quiet. But we're now actually working with quite a few people to try and get to that point where we just have a calendar of things and we, you know, we do it in a grown-up manner. Rather than me just going, oh, we need to do it every week. And I do post quite regularly. LinkedIn is our main channel. We're both, I don't know if you read Anxious Generation, but we both are anti-social media. So I have, Stephen doesn't have any, I have Instagram. When I have any, when I say any, this is excludes LinkedIn because we need that channel for work. But yeah, it's, We feel from the marketing perspective, two things, events and LinkedIn and connections, purposeful connections by introductions of other people bring us into the room with the people who are ready to buy the work.
Yeah, that makes sense. I quite like social media to a certain degree, although I was very glad to get off Twitter when that all went sour, and you can pick when that happened, but it was probably quite a long time ago, but. Yeah, you mentioned your values and I was going to, oh, you have five stated on the website and one of those being nerdiness, which I thought was fantastic. You've got very important ones, as you say, like meaningfulness and inclusion, but nerdiness being a stated value, I like that.
Yes, and sometimes get in the way because we do study things in depth, in a lot of depth, and we go sort of beyond of what's necessary sometimes, but super interesting. It's just like a lot of studio conversations for us start with, isn't it interesting? I just read about this and then rabbit hole ensues.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking about values and talking about where your work comes from. So, you know, hypothetical question, a client comes to you and they've got an unlimited budget, essentially. It's a really rich client. They want to work with you. What are your red lines? Who won't you work with? And what areas would be a no-go? I was going to save this actually for another episode, Rich, but I think as Alex is here, I think this could be an interesting one.
It's good. This is a good question, Andy. It actually happened to me in the beginning of my career that I really needed a job, the level of pay for my apartment, needed a job, pay for the room level. And the account was Philip Morris. So I said no. And then I cried all night thinking, what am I going to do? I had to work since I was 17, 16. And so throughout, I made those decisions both for myself and sometimes my team in different teams. And sometimes I always allowed them to make that decision. So for example, at some point, I remember when one of the agencies, there was this app that encouraged eating competitions. Like American, that thing. And yeah, none of my team wanted to work on that, and neither did I. So we had to come back to the founder and be like, you either just say no to the client now or on your own account, you outsource it somehow. So my red line. So it's not so much, I guess, the traditional, so traditional smoking, betting, the two things that come to mind straight away. But then there are real gray areas. I know, for example, some people, I haven't had to make that choice, but I know some people were working within defense and within those systems, but the systems were meant to look at like relocation of the family, like in a positive way, helping families relocate closer to the ones that are serving in the army, for example. And it's a question of personal values, whether you believe that your talent is contributing to something that is ultimately, as we know, in the political situation we're in the world, unfortunately, every country needs an army. And hopefully that's not something that is going to be used in the way that it's used in many points in the world right now. But it's like, is that a good project to look at? The person that I was talking to felt absolutely, and they helped a lot of families and they felt really good about it, despite the client is like technically an army client. And in a lot of pitches, scenarios and procurement, it would be like, you student work within that space. So for me, it's very much about personal value alignment. For example, I would never work for a smoking brand because my parents are both smokers and I dream of the day that they could stop. And I had since I was a child. And that didn't happen, unfortunately. Now they switched to cigarettes. Yeah. So it's better. Yes. But that really comes down to, like, I wouldn't work on it for my personal reasons, but I wouldn't judge anyone who would in that situation where you don't have a choice. I was lucky my dad could support me for a couple of weeks before I frantically searched for the other jobs. But what if I didn't have that choice? I don't know, like, when it's food, shelter versus the job. When you say in the unlimited budget and a client, at the moment, I would say no to quite a few things because we're doing well, we're scaling, and I don't believe that all the money in the world is going to make us happy. We want to be fulfilled through our jobs, and we choose to work with clients who do good stuff, who help, who, and it doesn't mean NGOs and doesn't mean charities. It means for profit, for benefit. People who help reduce emissions, people who decrease deaths at sea. That's one of our other clients. So kind of helping that is quite a good metric.
Have you ever come across anything like that at Clearleft?
Well, we did do a project for Vice magazine, no longer with us, which was paid for by William Morris. And on the face of it, it was an anti-smoking campaign. But probably in hindsight, it was a pro-vaping campaign. Masquerading as an anti-smoking one. But there can be difficult decisions to make around. So, Alex, you were talking about in defense. So, in this country, huge organizations, Serco, provides all manner of different systems and stuff to government. And so that includes doing defense-related systems, probably missile guidance systems, stuff like that, but also stuff for the NHS. And so there, I think it comes down to, well, are we working on missile guidance systems for Serco, or are we working for the NHS bit that it's doing, even though knowing that overall that company also does missiles? And I think you just have to take a view on that. It's like how hard a stance. I think in our case, because we're employee-owned, we would put something like that to the floor, to the other partners, to see if there's a decision to make. And it would kind of go down to individual choice to some degree. We would allow someone to say, I am really uncomfortable working on that particular project, and we wouldn't hold it against them. But we might still take on that piece of work, like I said, for a company that has different interests. And you have other similar things where, well, we don't want to do anything that involves a certain country that has awful human rights record, but it might be a kind of decent organization that is deciding to set up in that country, which may cause you to question how decent that organization is. But there's lots of nuance. There's always nuance for these things. And so for us, it comes down to a large degree of personal choice. And there are some obvious red lines, but they're blurry. Yeah.
We always had a rule because Alex, my daughter, you know, used to come home from school and I would be here in this room surrounded by my Godzillas, and I would never work on something that I felt that I wouldn't want her to see on screen. And Alex is a very strict vegetarian and always has been. So, you know, I've turned down projects from hunting organizations, for example. But that's always been my general rule. Is, you know, what would I be proud to show off? And there is always that balance between needing to, you know, feed the kids, but also what you want to be putting out on your portfolio and, you know, by association, be endorsing in some way or another. But we had a situation many years ago where there was a fairly local company that was in manufacturing, and they had this incredible process where literally at one end of the business was, you know, CAD design, and at the other end was a foundry. You know, they poured hot metal and made stuff, And I could just imagine how fabulously creative that could be. You know, you could do really amazing things with showing how they went from one to the other. And I'm walking around their plant and I picked something up and the guy said, oh, don't touch that. That's part of a control panel for an F-15 fighter plane. And at no point had they mentioned the military at this stage. So I went away and got back to them a little later and said, you know, just out of interest, how much of your business is military? And he said, well, at the moment it's around 40%, but we're hoping with the invasion of Iraq that it might be going up to kind of like 80. Why do you ask? And I said, well, you know, Sue and I have talked about it and, you know, we really like the creative opportunity for this job. But to make it kind of work for us, if, you know, we would take whatever percentage you said was your military income and we donate that to a landmine clearing charity. And he went, oh, fuck off. And we never heard from them again. Which I think was probably a narrow escape.
For the best.
Like it was. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Interesting. We've kind of just taken a couple of diversions there. But I'm always, particularly now, where things are so hyper-political, where the tension has been, you know, dialed up to the maximum. I mean, we're recording this a week after the government prescribed Palestinian action, where, you know, support for, you know, certain organizations has become kind of, you know, highly politicized. It does interest me how much of your own values affect the business.
Massively. This is all the choices we make. I think this is existing within commercial framework, sure, is one thing, but then living your life in a way that matters was always like a big thing for both me and Stephen. So it definitely affected. Yeah, but somehow, Andy, like we didn't have to make those choices, and not because like we have got approached by big clients, but usually people who sort of react to our content or align with our values, they already align with our values. So they don't, it's not the same people that you know, you were describing. I think they might not like
incredibly
us.
Rarely. Incredibly rarely do we, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it's probably the same with all three of our websites, but they tend to be filters. So the people that actually end up making contact with you are people that have gone through that filter and seen that, you know, hey, this guy creates websites with animated orangutans, you know, I'm an arms dealer. I don't think this guy's for me.
And there's those sort of ethical values, but I think also the ways of working as well. I imagine Alex Cosmic is similar to Fear Left in that you like to collaborate quite closely, and there needs to be straight out of the gate an amount of trust there. It has to be a partnership relationship, not a supplier relationship. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to do our best work. They're not going to be able to get the best work from us. And normally there's a certain amount of filtering that goes on either in a pitch process or even, as Andy was saying, before they get in contact in the first place. And that's normally a pretty good signifier of how the project's going to go, is how that interpersonal relationship works out.
Yes, I'll tell you more. I'll tell you a story about that. So yesterday, a friend of mine told me this wonderful story where she joined a project a year later. There's a design agency who designed and did a lot of research and everything else on a certain thing. And her first question was, what's the value proposition of this app? To which both the agency and the client said, we don't know. And that could have never happened in our context, because the first thing we look at is the business model, is the value proposition, is all these things where we speak the same language with the founders. And we sort of know if we're talking startups, that's with the founders. If we're talking like bigger companies, that's their kind of internal metrics, goals, and so on. But it's fundamentally, it's not so much about what we are sprinting to design. It's what we're trying to achieve. And I think that's what clients really value once they realize that is there and that support is truly huge. Recently, one of our clients recommended us to another client and we've kind of ended up working with all of them. And it's really, really nice to see and to keep fostering those relationships where we're talking the same language. So for me, when I see like business designer, aren't we like, should we? It's common sense that we need to understand the business model behind this app, this interface that you're about to put into the world. Like, how does it make money? Who does it make money for? What's the benefit that it brings to people? Yeah.
Yeah. And having those sorts of conversations with more public bodies, let's say. So we do a lot of work with universities and they might come to us and say, we need this part of the website redesigned. And so the first question is kind of why? What's that going to do for you? What are the outcomes that you actually want? You're going to be putting quite a lot of investment into this. Why do you need it to change? What are those changes going to accomplish? And what's the website doing now? And what needs to be different? Those sorts of questions have never been asked before in that context. With commercial clients, it's normally a bit more there because there's demands for return on investment and things like that. And sometimes that can be a bit narrow-minded and needs unpacking further as well. But yeah, it's that outcome, those outcome things. Yeah, the why, the good old five whys.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm aware that we have a hard stop today, but I would love you to come back before too long, certainly not 10 years from now, and we can have some more conversations like this. I do have one question, though, which is, have you been back to Lithuania recently?
Yes, I have. Maybe 3-4 months. My family's still there, yes.
No, I'm actually planning a road trip which will take me through all three of the Baltic states. So I know nothing about Lithuania, but it does look fascinating.
Oh, I can send you so many recommendations. I rave about like this. We're also like really amazing when it comes to tech scene and stuff like that and events and beautiful place. And well, to be honest, all the Baltic states, but Vilnius, the city where I was born. Most. So I can give you some tips on how and like where to go, what to do, what to eat, what not to.
I'm not gonna turn you down for a bit of advice. That's for sure. Well, listen, thanks for spending some time with us this afternoon. It's fascinating, and yeah, I mean it. Do come back and let's talk about some more stuff.
Very happy to. I can talk about our inclusive design study that we're just finishing. So hopefully. There will be, after a lot of analysis, there will be a State of Inclusive Design 2025 thing that we're going to be releasing into the world, which is very exciting because it's across eight
Well, let
countries.
Us know. Drop us an email and let us know when that's out. And we will definitely have you back to talk about that survey. That sounds fascinating.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Enjoyed our conversation. Love that we found so much in common. From the art degree to the age that we are.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
Wow.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I love talking to Alex. She's got such an amazing background. And yeah, I think when you've been in and around the industry for as long as she has, to then take the plunge to start off an agency, you've got to be quite motivated, I think, and to want to, yeah, like, now's the time where I'm going to stick to our values, find someone who shares my values, and then we'll go for it. And yeah, that's admirable.
That ended up being the accidental topic for the day, I think.
I think it does. There's definitely a lot of conversation, further conversation to be had along those lines, I think.
No, it absolutely fascinating. She is very sharp. I'd love to talk more with her about the process at some point. You know, she kind of alluded to this whole kind of, you know, designer developer dichotomy, but I'd really like to find a little bit more out about what they're doing, because I don't think it's a topic that, you know, gets covered often enough. Unless, you know, unless the stuff that people are doing is just so, you know, let's build it on a framework and it's like so rudimentary. But if you're doing creative stuff, how do you handle that communication? That's that could be really interesting to talk about.
Yeah, we had a really good talk at London before last. So last year, along those lines. So I forget the name of the speaker, but I will find out. And they could be a future guest because they definitely have some really interesting thoughts, including banishing the word handover.
Oh, okay.
We'll leave it at that.